evening. My name is Clancy Immersland. I'm an alcoholic. I'm very glad to be here tonight. I haven't spoken at a Northern California convention for 20 years or so. I had to wait for the entire committee to die off before I got invited back. But I was the first to tell them about the steps. But I see a lot of old friends here, a lot of some new friends, and several people here tonight who were at the Southern California Convention last weekend in San Diego, and we had a good time there, and hope we have a good time here. And I had a good trip up here, except that I was not feeling very well for some reason, and I ate something at noon that disagreed with me, and I've been kind of sick all afternoon, and I couldn't even eat a free dinner with the committee tonight. But I went and took a nap, and I feel a little better now. Someone before the meeting insisted I tell you about my really bad trip. I get so tired of talking about this trip, but it makes all the other trips look good. A couple of years ago, I was asked to speak in Reykjavik, Iceland, which is a long ways away. And on the way back, it's a long trip across the North Atlantic. And then I sat in the Minneapolis airport for about 4 hours waiting for a plane. And it's Sunday night and not much going on. I'm just tired and cross. And I was sitting in the red carpet room, which is the United Airlines frequent flyer room, and finally had to go to the can, and so I went in the washroom, and two little attractive little cubicles side by side, and I sat in one of them and meditated briefly, and all of a sudden a voice came from the other side and said, "Hi there." Oh, that must be some mistake. The voice... "Now, this lady is signing, but I don't see anybody who's watching her." Anyway, I sat there a little while longer, and the voice said, "What are you doing tonight?" And I was tired and cross. I thought, I'm bringing this settled now. So I said, "Look, I'm going back to Los Angeles to see my wife and children and grandchildren and great-grandchildren, and I appreciate your interest, but I'm fine. Thank you." I thought that would do it. And pretty soon the voice said, "We could really have some fun tonight if you wanted to." And I was tired and cross. I overreacted. "Look, I don't know what your problem is, pal, but drop it. Just do what you're supposed to do in here and leave me alone." There was a long pause, and the voice said, "I'll have to call you back. This asshole, the next stall, won't shut up." This trip was better than that. But I'm glad to be here, and I'm glad to see so many young people countdown. A lot of young people who are in their first month, a few months of sobriety, and I hope that you're on the right track. Great many people aren't. I wasn't. I spent a very difficult time in AA for many years. I was in and out year after year after year after year. Never got any time whatsoever. I just had a terrible time. And I used to wonder, how do other people can stop drinking and I can't? And it became clear to me really at my first meeting, and then it became more clear as the years went by. The main problem I've always had around AA, is that I'm not really an alcoholic, which is kind of a drawback when you go to AA. I mean, and so I had a long, eventful, filled life, and it wound up one day in a situation that cannot be for me. It can't happen to people like me. Two big guys threw me out of a skid row mission in Los Angeles and said, "Stay out of here, you mooch." And I tried to explain to them, "I'm not a mooch. 3 years ago, I was on the faculty of the University of Texas. Ads that I wrote, the LC and Elmer ads for the Borden Company, were running that very week in Life and Time and Saturday Post, New Yorker. I've had my picture in the New York Times for one of my achievements." How many people do you know have had their picture in the New York Times? But it's really hard to explain these things in midair. And I stood outside that damn old mission on a cold, rainy morning. I was sick. I had a terrible feeling. I didn't know what the feeling was. I know what it is now because I've seen it in others. I'm sure some people here have had it. But it's the sudden feeling that you realize there is no friendly direction. There's no place to go back to anymore. There's no place you can retreat to. You are on your own and nobody cares. And I just stood there and it was raining and I was so sick and I felt so bad. If some old guy would come to me that morning and said, "You know, Slim, you're dying. You're down to 120 some pounds. You've lost your wife and children. You'll never see them again. You've lost your career. Once upon a time they called you a boy genius. Now you can't get a job washing dishes. You've lost all your clothing. You lost out in a car that you lost in Denver or in Phoenix. That's that you were supposed to drive from Dallas. Guy asked you to drive a car from Dallas to Los Angeles. And you lost the car in Phoenix when you got drunk. And all your stuff was in it, all your clothes, all your ID. And you remember that day because that's the day they threw you in the Phoenix drunk tank and that guy kicked your front teeth out because you vomited on his bunk. You remember that because there's blood running down your front of your shirt. And if he said, "You know, your only child and your little mother up in Wisconsin is no longer allowed to accept phone calls from you because your stepfather is so tired of watching you play on her emotions, so she'll go down to her tiny little bank account and take out some more money and send it to her little boy and hope that'll help him. He'd rather have her think that you're dead than the way you are." And he might have said, "You've been going to AA now almost 10 years and you sit in these meetings and smirk and laugh and use it to take the heat off whatever problem you're in. And you know, this is just a bunch of nonsense. And now you're dying." And he might have said, "Why don't you go back to AA one more time and admit you're an alcoholic and see what happens?" And if some guy had said that to me, and if I were in a mood to be honest, I'd have to tell him, "Pal, you don't understand. It's not the way it looks. I'm not really an alcoholic. I wish I were. I'd give anything to be an alcoholic. My life would be so much more simple. But my life is not. My problem is not alcohol. I wish to hell it was, but it's not. I have a lot of problems, no question about that. But as a little boy, I knew I had problems. It always seemed to me that there was something missing in me, and it really accentuated. I got shoved ahead a year and a half in school because I could read fast when I was in third or fourth grade. And I went from being with peers to kids that were bigger than I am. And I was always that dumb little kid from the previous grade. And I always had to be to show off to prove that I was all right. But the one thing that characterized my childhood, I remember, there's something missing in me. I don't really fit in. People don't seem to like me as well as they like other people. I feel uncomfortable. It's almost as though if you're supposed to feel like this in life, for some reason or other, I was always feeling like this most of the time. And I thought, well, when I grow up, it'll be all different. And when I grew up, it was somewhat different, but it's still the same, just a more sophisticated series of emotions, feelings of not fitting in and feeling of clumsiness and feeling of awkwardness when I'm around people I want to impress. And I want to run with people who don't want to run with me, and people who want to run with me, I don't want to run with them, and on and on. And I thought, when I grew up and had some money, I could do something about it. So I spent several $1,000 in psychoanalysis to get to the root of my problem. And I really learned a great deal. Psychoanalysis is wonderful for people like me. Because all you ever find out is how you've been hurt in ways you don't understand. You know, when I found out that I had been scarred by the Depression, I didn't even know there'd been a Depression. But I felt, when he explained it to me, it really depressed me. And I was raised in something called the Norwegian Lutheran Church, very strict church. You don't see much around here. They're all. Let me tell you about the Norwegian Lutheran Church, the Norwegians of which I'm one. I spoke in Oslo a few years ago. They took me up north to a town near Lillehammer that my grandparents and his brothers had come from in the 1880s. A whole bunch of people left Norway for the Americas in the 1880s to get out of that damn climate. Then they got here. And they all settled in Montana, North Dakota, and Wisconsin, Minnesota. And they spent the rest of their life sitting around saying, "Jesus is cold here too." You know, just dummies. That's the kind of head I have to greet every morning when I wake up. But I discovered that I had been repressed by the Norwegian Lutheran Church. I didn't know that, but when I found out, I could see I had been. That really hurt me a lot. I found out a lot of things. I really remember you thinking, "God, I come out of there. No wonder I have these bad feelings. I really had a terrible life. You know, I've overcome a lot of problems. And have a few drinks and think about it." And it took several $1,000s to realize Just a minute now. I know why I have all these emotions. It's great. But the problem is I still have them. So what good is that to know why? The only possible use might be late at night in a bar somewhere. Some big mope comes over and says, I better listen to you mouth off all night long. What the hell's wrong with you? Then you can tell him. I was repressed by the Norwegian Lutheran Church. Hush. I read books. I did a lot of things. But I always was fighting my emotions. But the greatest help I ever had, I discovered, when I was 15, I was a nervous, restless, skinny, pimply-faced boy about to junior in high school, going to graduate, and I was 16. And I was just not having I was having a hard time getting along. And the war came along, and which saved me in a way, and did many people, because at least it took my mind off myself briefly. And when the war had gone a little while, I thought, that's what I'll do. I'll become a Marine. I'll go over there and kill Japs. I was watching movies where they were killing Japs. That looked like a good idea. So I hitchhiked to San Francisco. Now, that may not seem like much, but I'd never been more than 50 miles from home. And the guy said, how did I get there? He said, well, I'll give you a ride to Minneapolis. Then you can hitchhike from there. So I stood outside of Minneapolis. I told my mother I was going to Superior to visit my aunt. She gave me my little bag and my bus fare. That's what I had to travel with. And I stood outside of Minneapolis, and the car stopped. He said, where are you going, kid? I said, San Francisco? He said, so am I. Hop in. He turned out to be a guy going back to Navy, and gave me a ride all the way to San Francisco. I couldn't believe it. I'd like to find that guy someday. He must be a saint to put up with my nonsense and juvenile conversation and idiocies. And we, you know, we stop at night. There were no motels then, but there were trailer cars. He'd give me a bed. He'd get a bed, and I didn't think anything about it. He bought my meals. I thought, that's the way it is when you hitchhike, I guess. You tell them where you want to go, and they get you there, for all I know. And I really was just terribly dumb. And we get to San Francisco. He says, you know, kid, you're never going to get the Marine Corps. You're this high. You got a face full of pimples. You're really a stupid kid. And he says, but you might be able to get the Merchant Marine, because they're crying. All the good guys go in the Navy, and they'll take almost anybody. So you have to go to the guy. I'm going to drop you off at the Coast Guard office. Go ahead and tell him you're 16, not 15. Tell him you want to be in the Merchant Marine. So he dropped me off, and I had a little in my bag and up on Market Street somewhere. I went and said, I want to be in the Merchant Marine. The guy said, how old are you, kid? I said, 16. He says, fill out this application. So I filled it out. He says, well, you're 16, kid. You have to have your parents' permission. So I took it around the block, got my parents' permission. And I'll tell you how desperate they were for seamen. They gave me seamen's papers right there at the desk, temporary, permanent ones later. Sent me with another guy to the National Maritime Union down Montgomery Street. I didn't know what the hell that was about. I said, going to sign dues to, you know, for your... you're going to sign a waiver for your dues. What the hell that means? I didn't know, so I signed it. And they took another guy now over to the Embarcadero and put us on a ship. And that afternoon, we were on the way to the South Pacific. And it really was fun for about an hour. As long as we were moving it. That's where the World's Fair was last year. That's Alcatraz. That's the Golden Gate Bridge. Then after that, there's nothing. And the guy said, get to your forecastle. I didn't know what a forecastle was, but it sounded ominous to me. If you're better in a ship, you know, that's where the crew sleeps. They sent me to this, what they called a cabin. It was not a cabin. It was a room. If you live in Wisconsin, cabins have logs. This was a room. And there were three of the worst type of people that any small, skinny, dumb Norwegian Lutheran kid can ever be with. And these people are called men. What the hell are you supposed to be? I could see there was some little tension in the air, so I told him one or two jokes that I was used to go over good in study hall and go over there. Get your bunk and shut up. I still remember lying in that bunk and that ship was moving. I never felt that feeling. It was hot in there, it seemed to me. And I felt terrible. These guys start talking. Because they'd been in San Francisco for 3 days or so before they unloaded the ship. And they were sinners. I mean... I'm a Lutheran, and I can spot sinners, and they were sinners. They had been doing terrible things with women. And I said, I, of course, they've all got black hair. These are the Catholics I've heard about. I don't want to give the wrong impression. Even at the age of 15 in Eau Claire, Wisconsin, I'd had sex. But I'd been apprehensive and I'd been afraid and I'd been alone. And these guys were doing it with people. I couldn't believe it. But eventually I found a role on that ship. I became the ship fool, you know. Hey, kid, go down and tell them. Down in the engine room, tell them we need a left-handed wrench. Hey, kid, go up on the bridge, tell the captain we need some elbow grease. And these guys would sit around at the end of the watch and drink whiskey. They weren't supposed to have on ships at that time. Who's going to stop them? And I used to watch them drink this whiskey. I'd never been close to a bottle of whiskey. That's just terrible. And one day one of these guys turned to me and says, how about you, Junior? You think you're man enough for a little snort? And I draw the line there. I may be dumb and I may be stupid and small, but I'm not a sinner. I thought, I better tell this guy once and for all, I'm not going to put up with this. And I was just going to tell him. I was going to say, you big dummy. You get that whiskey out of my face. I have to be a Norwegian Lutheran. I guess you didn't know that. Maybe you don't know people like us. We don't drink whiskey. I promise my mother and grandmother wouldn't anyway. And don't you ever put that whiskey in my face again. I'm just going to tell him that. Just demolish him. He said, well, do you think you're man enough? I heard a voice say, God damn right. Yeah. So I had my first drink of whiskey out of the first bottle. I was closer to that. I threw it up, and they all laughed. To this day, I don't know any emotion that's worse than public humiliation, where you're just embarrassed and humiliated, and there's nothing you can do about it. I remember I felt so bad. I wanted to hit this guy because they laughed at me, and I couldn't hit him, couldn't do anything. I thought later, there's one thing I might have done. I'm glad I didn't think of it. They'd have thrown me overboard. We would have been cute, you know. All right, you, lean over. Yeah. Take that. Just give him one in the old eye just to teach him a lesson. But all the way across the Central Pacific, nobody was looking out seeing this guy, one of these guys' sea bags, and take a drink of whiskey. And I hated it. And I'd throw up and wipe it up, but I wanted so desperately for those guys to like me. I thought if I didn't throw up, they'd have thought I was a man. They wouldn't have, of course, but I didn't know that. We were just coming into Pearl Harbor finally. They're still digging up the ships around us. And I was down there taking a drink of this crap the night before my 16th birthday. And I took a drink of the crap. And at first day I didn't throw it up. It's just terrible. Oh, God. So all of a sudden something strange happened. I found myself feeling significantly better. And I didn't think much about it. You know, when you're a kid growing up, you don't think about things. You learn things. Everybody in that ship smoked. I didn't smoke. Nobody I knew smoked. But they smoked, so I smoked and puked and smoked and puked. And one day I didn't puke, and I smoked 2.5 or 3 packs a day every day for the next 40-some years. Then I realized it was making me bald. I want to say one thing. It is really getting bad in America now, the way they treat smokers. I had to stop smoking a while back because they took a little bit of my vocal cords from some other reason. But it's funny, he'd been telling me for 5 years, for you to smoke is to die, for you to smoke. Yeah, yeah. He only had to say once, for you to smoke, you may go mute. But even before I stopped smoking, people think they have the right to come up to total strangers and say things like, why do you smoke? Don't you realize that secondhand? Just rude, nasty. And smokers have to go outside in the rain and smoke down. You drive down the streets. You know. And even though I don't smoke, I'm a smoker by nature. And for those of you who smoke, I'm going to share something with you that I had developed in my own life. And if you weren't at this meeting tonight, you ever would, never would have heard it. Next time someone comes up to you and says, why do you smoke? I'm going to give you an answer they'll never ask you again. You say, why do I smoke? I have a feeling that one of these days they'll find a market for phlegm and I'll be rich. That's I hadn't thought of that for a long time, but there's something about this crowd that brings that sort of thing out. And I didn't become a terrible alcoholic. I tried to learn to... they teach me to swear a little bit. They taught me to, you know, told me how to approach girls. None of the ways I ever tried ever worked, but at least I had approaches. And got another ship later on. I went in the Navy, and I was old enough, 17, and then the war was a naval hospital up in Northern California, outside of San Francisco, being sewed together, and they passed around some tests. I've always been good on tests, because I can read fast. So they gave me a high school diploma. So I got a high school diploma through the Navy at the end of the war, and went back to Wisconsin after the war and went to the University of Wisconsin and won some trophies for the university. Got married in college to a lovely, dark, black-haired, black-eyed, mysterious girl who, after she won my heart, dropped a big one on me. I'm a Catholic. I struggled in the net, but she had me. So we got married, and I went out in the world. I became a sports writer, newspaper sports writer, which is still one of my favorite jobs I ever had. Incidentally, I want to say to you folks from up here in Northern California, I'm sorry that the Angels knocked the Oakland Athletics out of the playoffs today. I'm sorry that the Dodgers clinched the pennant against the Red Giants today. But I'm here to talk about love, actually. You shouldn't be grudging. We get screwed all the time down there. We don't need the help we can get. And I love that sports writing job. I'll still be doing it, I suppose, except my wife began manifesting the terrible patterns of alcohol, of Catholics, that I didn't know about. And if you're not a Catholic, you won't know about it. But if you marry a Catholic girl, and she's a good girl, you are about to have a big family, bucko. You know. And I became a national distributor of small Catholics. I remember saying to my wife, can't we use birth control? No. I don't know what I'd have done if she had said yes. It's hard for young people to realize it, but in those days, nobody talked about that sort of thing. I'd been overseas, I'd been through a university, and I heard the word condom once, I think, in a Navy training film where they showed this lovely girl and what would happen with her if you didn't have a condom. And, of course, that stage left, I didn't care what would happen if I could just have her. Yeah. And, you know, guys, what you got then, nobody talked about this thing. What you find is kind of reckless, devil-may-care kids would say things like, I got a rubber. And even they'd be ashamed to go in and buy it. They'd have to hire somebody depraved to buy it. And even they'd be ashamed. They'd say, hey, give me some cigarettes. And some rubbers. Now look how much progress we've made in the last 50 years. The Rite Aid store by my house, kids came in, say things like, hey, I want some condoms and some cigarettes. That's it. So I had to get better jobs. I got in advertising and public relations over the years, did a lot of things. And all these years I drank and caroused and raised hell and did the things that I thought veterans did. The only problem I'll tell you something. Alcohol is the best friend I ever had. Now, if you're new, that may sound dreadful in a meeting, but it is. Friends come and go. Lovers come and go. Jobs come and go. Cities come and go. States come and go. But when you're feeling bad and drinking makes you feel better, you can get that anywhere. And I thought about that damn scale followed me through much of my life. And what alcohol, I didn't know at the time, what alcohol does for me, it gets rid of it briefly. There's no scale. Hey, baby. And maybe when you get sober, there's back again. But it's so nice not to have that, those feelings all the time, to feel like you're something. But I have a tendency, the only problem I've ever had with it, I have a tendency sometimes to drink too much. Or as I learned in psychoanalysis, I have been many times thoughtlessly overserved. And when I do, I act bizarrely. And so I was sent to my first AA meeting. Not sent to, just recommend I go, because he said some of these old drunks in town are staying sober, or getting, or at least they're cutting down to drinking. So I went to my first AA meeting in 1949. That's a long time ago. A lot of you little snots weren't even born. We love you. And I don't know what I expected to find. What I found was a bunch of old fat guys sitting around the table. And they looked at me like I was just got off that ship again. You know, when I got in the ship, you know. Because I was 22, which is not very young in AA now. But at that time, no one had heard of anybody within 15 years of it in that state. He said, "What the hell are you supposed to be?" I said, "Well, they suggested I come here." He said, "Do you think you're an alcoholic?" And I tried to be honest. I said, "No, I don't really think I'm an alcoholic." He said, "What do you think's wrong with you?" And I tried to be honest. I said, "I think I'm too sensitive." I never told anybody else that for a long time, I'll tell you. But I hung around there for a while. But the rules, if you're new tonight, your rules are very quite simple. You admit that your problem is alcohol, and therefore your life is screwed up. And then you stop drinking. Then you return to God, and life works out. And unfortunately, that doesn't fit people like me. Because my problem really isn't drinking. I don't know how to explain that to people, but my problem is not drinking. My problem is a scale or the version, the emotions that go to make it up. And I drink to get some relaxation. And sometimes I drink too much. So maybe I got to find a way to not drink so much. But my problem is not alcohol. And even if it were, I can't return to God. Maybe some people can return to God, but when you're a Norwegian Lutheran and you've been an absolute sinner, I mean, in our church, you break three or four commandments and you're really on the edge. And when I came to AA, I'd broken 10 out of 10, I felt. And that's some of them accidentally, but I broke them. And it wasn't until I was sober some years that I realized I really haven't broken all the commandments. I've never coveted my neighbor's manservant. But that's why I stay out of San Francisco, really. But I hung around AA for a while, and I'd hear things. I don't know what they were saying, but it seemed to me they were saying things like, "I stayed drunk around the clock for 20 years. One day I walked through that door, and they told me to put the plug in the jug, and I did. And I've just never been so goddamn happy." I got a job working for Fairbanks Morse in their advertising department in another city. And I did well, except that I was under a lot of pressure. I drank a little too much. I thought, they're going to give me a fire me or something. But I went to the boss. AA wasn't very well known then. I said, "You know, Mr. Collins, this new thing called AA that helps people like me with a problem of drinking. Could you give me a couple of weeks just to try it out and see if it works?" He said, "Oh, sure, good idea." So I was AA there, the same old crap. But at least it gives you a couple of weeks to look for a new job. And from then on, I worked in a lot of places around the country, and I had a pretty good resume, and I could always get a new job. And sooner or later, I'd either lose it with an emotional explosion or a drinking explosion or something. But every time the heat was on, I'd go to AA, because it looked good. And as I say, AA wasn't very well known. You could go home at night and say things like, "Well, I've gone back to AA, dear." Wonderful. Wonderful. Betty says it really helped her husband. Wonderful. What do they want you to do? "Well, they want me to taper off." And there wasn't any Al-Anon then to screw it up for everybody. Ever since the birth of Al-Anon, there's never been a moment's rest for anybody anywhere. "No, they don't. You can't drink at all. You're supposed to have abstinence. We know that. We have the same stuff you do. I release you, you son of a bitch." So I had ups and downs and had a better job. And I went up and down and up and down. And finally went down after a number of years in Dallas, where I had a good job in the largest advertising agency in the South. As I said, writing these LC Delmer ads for the Borden Company, but I got drunk and missed some work. It cost them an accountant. I got fired. They'd called my wife and said they were going to fire me. And she'd been getting advice to leave me for a long time. So when when I was spending the 2 or 3 days of drinking up my severance check, she took the kids and moved out, and I got home, and there was no house, no family, no furniture. She'd sold out my clothes in a pile. The company all of a sudden took the back of the car. And 4 days ago, I was a big shot. And here I'm standing on the streets of Dallas with my clothes and no place to turn. And a friend of mine, fortunately, had a... He said, Clancy, I need a car delivered in Los Angeles. You want to drive? I said, oh, yes, I sure do. And that's how I got as far as El Paso and got drunk and went to Phoenix and got drunk and lost the car and got my teeth kicked out. And all of a sudden, I'm in front of the Skid Row Mission, the Midnight Mission in Los Angeles, dying. And the one thing I always knew, I wish my problem had been alcohol, because I would have quit a long time ago. But nobody came up and talked to me, and I had to do what you have to do in your deal like that. I said, try to find an AA club and maybe get some help. And I found, where's an AA club? He said, well, it's out in Wilshire and Fairfax. So I said, where the hell's that? And he said, well, Wilshire doesn't come all the way down here. You have to take this hill up to Hill Street and then cut over to Wilshire, then walk west. And I did that in the rain. And some years later, I counted my car. That's 72 long blocks. God, that's a long way to walk when you're sick and desperate. My mouth was bleeding again by now, and my clothes were dirty. My coat was torn. I remember driving up the street and people going by in cars and pointing, oh, look at that. And thinking, how could this be happening to me? And I got to that damn old club, and it's just like all clubs everywhere. The 12 steps, the 12 traditions. Turn it over to God. Live and live. First things first. But it was raining. I had to stay out of the rain, so I lurked around that damn club, and I had a meeting. I had about 4 pounds of cake. At least I could chew that. And then somebody talked about gratitude, and I almost puked it up again. And after the meeting, everybody went home, and it was raining. I thought, I better put on my newcomer look. I got to do something here. After that, I said, I'm a newcomer, and I have no place to stay, but I want the program. He said, you're in luck, kid. Guy named Joe Quinn from left an old 49 Merc in the parking lot last summer. You can sleep in that. You want me to sleep in an abandoned car? Say, a good deal, huh? And I still remember sleeping in that car and cold and sick, my mouth hurting. I think, God, how could this be? And the next morning was Sunday. I went in the club, and as soon as they opened up, we had about 4 pounds of cake. Then they had a spiritual meeting. And somebody talking about God or Jesus that I just didn't want to hear about. And then I lurked around the club, and there's another meeting, and some more cake, and I ate and listened to their crap and slept in an abandoned car. This went on for days. It just kept raining, and I just remember thinking, maybe I'm dead. I remember thinking, maybe this is what hell is. Maybe it isn't fire and brimstone. It's just being sick and raining and your mouth hurts every moment and you're hungry. And every day someone talks to you about AA. And that was the worst I ever felt. And I had no idea then or thereafter that would be my sobriety date. Didn't want it to be. Had no intention for it to be my sobriety date. I just wanted to get out of there as fast as soon as it stopped raining. I thought about that a lot. Why, of all that, there's several times in my life I really wanted to stop drinking. I was in jail one night, overnight. I went to jail a lot overnight. Because I have a tendency, when I'm drinking too much, to counsel police officers. Which is a short-term occupation, I'll tell you. I got to jail one morning, and guy said, God, you should have been home last night. Client says, I know, I'm going to shape up. Well, you were out drunk, your little son died, and we couldn't find you. Oh, God, it almost made me crazy. He had a bunch of little daughters and one little boy, and he had died, and they couldn't find me. I don't recall ever feeling any worse than that. I still remember that weekend sitting with my father-in-law and my two brothers-in-law, they were big farmer guys, and sat around a table, and they all, here, Clancy, you want some coffee? Have some cupcakes, and smiles. But in their eyes, you could just see, you dirty, rotten bastard. You dirty, what have you done to our sister? You know, and we buried my little son, and I put my hand in his casket, and nobody's looking. I said, Clancy, his name was John. I said, John Emerson, this will never happen in our family again. I promise you. And I stopped drinking. And I was working in Texas then, and it was just like almost like Easter, what Easter should be. Somebody died, but they died to make us all better. And we lived in happiness for a while. It was just wonderful. And we said our prayers at all our meals for little John, but we all. And then something happened. has happened to me every time I stop drinking. This time it took a little longer. Whenever I stop drinking, the reason I know I'm not an alcoholic, because I can, these people get a craving, they can't stop. I can stop anytime. My problem is after I stop, sooner or later, somebody sneaks into my bedroom in the middle of the night and puts an invisible spring in my gut. And the next morning, they start to tighten it. And it comes out as just a little growing irritability. And a little restlessness. And a little tired of being lectured to by people who are living off my abilities, God damn it. And on, being treated like a piece of crap. And that pressure mounts. And I've discovered over the years, the only way to really cut that is to have a few drinks. That's why I drink. I eventually always drink, but I don't drink because I'm a drinker. I drink because I have these damn feelings. Now, this time, somebody snuck into my bedroom and put a spring in my gut, and it got pretty bad, and now I have additional resentments. God, that I just hate! You killed my little boy to punish me. He didn't do a sin in the world. I'm a dirty, rotten son of a bitch, and you killed him to punish me. How could you do such a thing, you nasty thing? And my job, I didn't like anymore. And my daughters, who I was trying to help, Mary, take your sisters and go to your room. For Christ's sake, I'm sorry, honey. We'll play them. And all I needed was about three or four drinks. I could have cut that. But when you're taking a vow in your son's casket, you can't take a drink. So one day, my wife took the kids to church, and I pulled my car in the garage and shut the door and put a hose on the exhaust pipe and turned the motor and went to sleep and died. And just by a fluke, guy next door was sitting in his kitchen and watched me go in there and heard the motor running. I didn't come out, so he ambled over to see if I was all right and found me dead in the car and pulled me out and beat on my chest and rushed me to the hospital and examined me and determined I was seriously mentally ill and committed me to the state insane asylum in Big Spring, Texas. And I was there till the next year. Something like that looks bad in your resume, I'll tell you. But that's how I get when I stop drinking. When I really want to stop. And I didn't want to stop at all. And I thought, how in the world did I ever stop this? I'll tell you what it really boils down to kind of quickly. The one thing that always kept me out of AA were the first three steps. They're nice steps, but they have no application to people like me. I'm going to admit my problem is alcohol, and therefore my life's screwed up. I'm going to have God restore me to sanity. Then I'm going to turn my life over to God. That's ridiculous. Ridiculous. Can't pay your rent? Turn over to God. You know what's going to happen? You're going to sleep outside. That's all that's going to happen to you. And what happened to me is that a guy used to come to the meetings. That was a movie actor. And he captured my... Because he was a real movie actor. I seen him in the movies. That was something, you know. You can't take Wisconsin out of the boy very well. Now I know he's just a small-time character. I've been in more movies in the last few years than he ever was. But at the time, he was something. And then they started grinding me. Get a sponsor! Time to get a sponsor! I thought, I'll get Bob, the movie actor, to be my sponsor. And I'll worm my way into his love, and we'll share his fame and fortune, and I'll get out of here. And I just had a mental image. Someday, I'll get some clothes and some teeth for this goof. And I'll go back to New York and say, yes, I was a drinker, but now I've learned my lesson. I'll stay sober. I'll get a job. If someone's just probation, I'll write very well. They'll hire me. I'll make some money. I'll come back to Los Angeles one day. I'll come here and I'll buy this club. And I'll burn it down. And I hope they're having a big club meeting that day and they're all burned up. So I said, Bob, will you be my sponsor? He said, sure, kid, but I want you to do what I tell you. Oh, sure, Bob. I found out later he didn't like me. I don't blame him at all. If you ever worked with new people, and I've done this, I've seen it others, you know, the worst form of newcomer is a long-term slipper who knows all about it. I think you're misquoting the book there, aren't you? Boom! Boom! But he tried to help me a couple times. He took me with him to talk, and he'd talk to me sometimes, and he really tried to help me, I guess. But what he did, somewhere along the line, he started talking about something one day that caught my attention. I may have heard it before, but I never realized it. He said either to me or somebody, he said, if you think your problem is alcohol, you should get out of AA. Huh? Now what? You're too long under those hot lights on the set for him, I guess. I said, what are you talking about, Bob? He says, no, the problem here is not alcohol. I said, don't be so silly. It's in the steps that says it is. Now stop it. He says, kid, if your problem is alcohol, you shouldn't be around AA. You should get out of here. You got an answer. You don't need all this stuff. Oh, really? What is it, Bob? He said, if your problem is alcohol, how you beat it is this. You quit. Oh, Jesus. I've done that many, many times. It doesn't work, Bob. Because I know that doesn't work for you or for me, because our problem isn't alcohol. Our problem is something that sounds like alcohol, and a lot of people are confused by it, so they die from it. It's something called alcoholism. And, oh, man, come on, Bob, don't play word games with me. I look terrible, but I'm smart. Alcoholism. He gave me a lot of talk about that. I remember the most succinct thing he said, and it was near the end. He said, look, kid, put it this way. An alcohol problem is overcome by stopping drinking and cleaning up your act and living a little bit better. That's all you do. People do it all the time with alcohol problems. However, in this strange thing called alcoholism, which unfortunately for you and me looks almost exactly the same to the naked eye, this mind-consuming, perception-distorting, bodily-eroding, eventually fatal thing called alcoholism, you'll discover that stopping drinking and cleaning up your act has no significant long term on your life other than to gradually make it so painful you can't stand it. I said, Jesus, Bob, that's me, that's true, but if it's so bad like that, why do people drink then? If it's doing this to them, why do they drink? He said, that's the whole point. They never seem to understand this, newcomers. It isn't what alcohol does to you at all. That's not the problem here. That's simple. The curse of alcoholism is something entirely different. There are about maybe 9 or 10% of drinkers have an unnatural reaction to alcohol. You know what that unnatural reaction is? It gives them a craving and they can't stop drinking. And not at all. That's all nonsense. It's this. It must do something special for them that it doesn't do for most people. When I drink, it must almost instantly alter my perception of reality. It must almost instantly change my relationship to the world around me. It must almost instantly make me taller and more self-contained and them smaller and less threatening. I said, Jesus, Bob, what's wrong with that? Because if it does that for you, kid, it eventually gets to you. You got to have it after a while. And then it does set up this phenomenon of craving. I don't know what, I can't explain that to you, but it seems to be there. And I've thought about that a lot over the years. I have a theory of that phenomenon of craving. I don't know, for other people, it may not be, but for me, when I look back at my life, when I drink, it moves me into a different place. And almost instantly, I think, you begin to sag back. And you instinctively have to keep drinking. I don't even know why. Just give me more drinks. You're so drunk you can't hardly stand up. Give me a drink. I don't want to go back to Kansas. I want to be here in Oz. And eventually you get drunk and it's all gone anyway. But drinking has to do something special for me. I never realized it was something special. I thought it did that for everybody. I said, well, Jesus, Bob, I understand that. But then if you stay sober, why would people drink again? Jesus, if they know it's going to do that, it's so terrible. He said, they don't have much of a chance, kid. He said, my theory, and I believe this theory with all my life, from what I've seen. He said, when everybody grows up in the world, people grow up, they face conflicts and problems and ups and downs and situations. And you learn how to live. You learn what's important, what's not important, what to do with things, how to get along with people. That's called maturing. A mature personality is one who lives pretty much at peace in the world, and he doesn't have big ups and downs, and he does pretty well. He says, people like us don't ever have that. Because along the way, when we find conflicts and problems, we have discovered that a few drinks gets rid of them. Here's to you, household finance. And problems and situations and relationships can't sustain anything. And it's fine, except one day, now you got to get sober. And this time when you get sober, although you don't know it, you have to face all the emotions that you haven't handled. I never would have guessed in 10,000 years what was happening to me was this. I had a grown-up body, a grown-up brain, grown-up strength, grown-up verbal skills, grown-up abilities, and never once guessing that I'm at the intermittent beck and call of childish emotions. We call them alcoholic emotions because it's a little nicer to say it that way. But what are alcoholic emotions? I love you. I hate you. I'm going to run away. You hurt my feelings. Let's get married. And eventually you get so out of whack that you got, it starts to come up and you got to get some relief. And the relief is with a few drinks. And eventually the drinking gets to be too much so you get sober. And then you stay sober until it gets so bad you got to drink. Then you drink and you get sober. And every time back and forth, your mind tells you one thing. But you know it's not the alcohol. It's all these other things. People don't understand that. You're kind of sensitive and you're misunderstood and you need some love and you need a lot of things. They just think you're drinking too much. They don't know. And that's why people like us at a phenomenal rate die from it. Just think, it's been estimated 1991, the most recent, or 2001 rather, National Institute of Health issued some figures. And somebody there estimated that of alcoholics of our type, something over 90% still die drunk or as a direct result of drinking. But they die knowing one thing, but I'm not really an alcoholic. You don't understand. My case is different, the universal cry. But if he told me about that, I said, Jesus, Bob, that sounds like me, what you saw. He said, I think it is you. There's a name for people like you. I thought, uh-oh. What is it, Bob? He said, you're an alcoholic. I thought, well, I'll be damned. I've just thrown away 10 years of my life and everything I have because I could never find a definition of alcoholic that seemed to fit me with all my emotions. And I accepted that. That was January of 1959, I guess, and I've never doubted it since. I remember telling Bob, why for God's sake doesn't AA explain it instead of all this fantasies and allergies of the bodies, all that crap? He says, we do explain it. It's in the first step. You have to admit your problem is alcohol, and you have another problem with sobriety. That's all. Oh, yes, I knew that. Well, I'll tell you, it's a funny thing. I was in January of 1959, and I've never had a strong desire to drink since that day. And you might think, isn't that wonderful? His life turned out beautifully. Not at all. My life was terrible. I knew it, but I still had a rotten attitude. I had a rotten disposition, smart mouth. I looked terrible. I had old clothes, no front teeth. Get jobs and get fired and on and on. And a couple times I really contemplated suicide. In a couple of years, I just can't keep this up. I can't do it. I'm hopeless. But why do I think of drinking? Because I'll tell you why. All those years I was in and out of AA, I used to sit in the meetings and kind of smirk to myself. And some more slippers would come back and talk about how bad it was and how their friend shot himself and how they lost everything. I thought, Jesus, if I drank like those guys, I would never slip. And I determined never to drink again. If it gets bad, I'll commit suicide, but I won't drink. And eventually he got me to do things. And little by little, things got a little better. And when I was 2 years old, I finally got a 2 years old, I got a little job as a writer in a medical corporation. Still didn't have any front teeth. Had to learn to carry my lip like this. But I went to work every day. My sponsor was a fanatic on that, and I got to be director of advertising for that corporation. I had front teeth then, and then I went to work in Hollywood. Another guy and I created something called Boss Radio, became the number one hard rock station in the world. And I was 10 years sober, I was doing public relations with oil companies. 15 years sober, I was a marketing director in Beverly Hills. Shit. When I was 5 years sober, the same wife and all those children heard the crinkle of green in my wallet. All the way to Dallas, leaped out of their post office box, rushed to my side. 9 months and 10 seconds later, another Catholic hit the street. Thank God somebody gave me a book on the rhythm system. So that's the end of that. They're all grown up, and Three of my daughters turned 15 this year in Alcoholics Anonymous. The others aren't alcoholics. If you had a loving father, you'd have stayed sober too. I have a son. I say to him, Clancy, are you drinking too much? Oh, no, Dad. I'd let you know if I were. But I happen to know that his wife has been going to Al-Anon for a year. Maybe she just wants to be empowered. I don't know. One of my kids has turned out bad. You hate to talk about it because it's kind of sad. But my oldest daughter became a judge. We had so hoped for a defense attorney, but no. She comes home at Christmas. She says, remember, Daddy, when we were little girls, you used to send us to our room? I said, sure, honey. She said, when you come to Albuquerque, I'm going to send you to a little room. I want to quickly just cover a couple more things. I don't want to get off these terrible stories. But after I was sober a little while, they started in on me again, as they always do if you're around these fanatics. Time to dark the steps. Bob said, we're going to look through the steps. I said, Bob, I cannot return to God. That's the next step. I cannot do that. I wish I could. But if God exists, I am convinced I am damned. I have to believe there's no God or he doesn't know where I am or something. He says, it doesn't say that at all. I said, oh, a higher power. Is that fool you, boys and girls? He doesn't fool me. I know who they're talking about. He says, look, kid, why don't you read it? He said, you come to believe that there's a power greater than yourself. Can't you believe that? Can't you believe in God? I said, no, I can't. He says, can't you believe in AA? No, I can't, Bob. He says, you think I'm doing better than you are? Yeah, of course you are. He says, congratulations, I'm your new higher power. And he became my power, and I could accept that, because he could not send me to hell. He tried, but he couldn't. And the great thing to remember when you're working through the steps, when you get to the second step, you do not have to know what is happening. All you have to do is try to come to believe that a power exists. That's what? Restore you to sanity. What does that mean? People who are half crazy don't like to talk about being restored. I'm not crazy. I say, it's the odd thing about insanity. You know, what is sanity? Sanity is almost impossible to define. You can read 10 books on mental health, they have 10 different definitions. But oddly enough, insanity is easy to define. Psychosis is easy to define. In a sense, oversimplified. Psychosis is when the brain is under sufficient conflict, sufficient pressure, to maintain integrity, it will make a portion of reality look different than it is to relieve that pressure. Sometimes it happens as the whole world's gone, then you're in hospital. Sometimes just a little bit. We talk about these people, gee, he was a good neighbor until this one day something shot all these people. You can't tell. But psychosis is something that once you get it, you just about always keep it. Sometimes you hear people say, well, I was psychotic for a while, then I got over it, then I'm psychotic. That just means what you're meaning to say is that you're very neurotic and very pained. But when you become psychotic, you usually stay psychotic. Now, here's an interesting thing. Alcoholics almost never become psychotic. Isn't that funny? You'd think they'd be the number one candidates for it. But cases of alcoholics becoming psychotic are as slim as hen's teeth. And why is that? Because when it gets bad enough, long enough, I drink alcohol, which alters my perception of reality. I have the ability to temporarily induce psychosis. I don't know it, but I can. You think, well, why don't these other people who are getting goofy, why don't they drive? They do. But alcohol doesn't change their perception of reality. It just makes it maybe fuzzier, maybe a little sicker. So I had to come to believe is this. You don't have to believe. You have to don't know how it happened. You have to understand how it's going to happen. You just have to believe it can happen. And you have to believe that because you're surrounded by people for whom it has happened. And you must accept that testimony. But all you got to believe in the second step is this. You got to believe there's a power somewhere here that will enable you to live in the world without having to induce psychosis. you will be able to sustain reality on a continuing basis. You have to come to believe there's a power greater than myself will restore me to sanity. And that's all. It isn't all the people interpretations and stuff into it. God, they just make the step so convoluted it makes it unbearable. As Dr. Bob said, they mean what they say. They mean what they say. So you got to admit that you got to have some problem with alcohol. You have some problem with sobriety. You can never change the alcohol part, but maybe you can change the sobriety. So you're going to try to come to believe that maybe there's some power here that will enable me to live. I don't see how it could possibly be, but I got to try to believe it does exist. Then you've taken two steps. And the third step and last step that I could never handle, turn your will and your life over to God. That's too much. I can't do that because I know better than that. So I went on without that. When I was about 6 months sober, I got fired as a dishwasher one day through... Not my fault. It seemed to me that the busboys were bringing in more dishes than the waitresses were taking out. So I thought these guys were getting them in other restaurants to humiliate me because I was an Anglo. How's that? Well, I decided to commit suicide that day. I just thought, 6 months sober, I can't hold a job as a dishwasher, and people I wouldn't hire to mow my lawn are succeeding all around me. What the hell is this? There's something wrong inside of me. I decided to walk to the ocean. I remember I was in my mind's eye, a star was born. The guy goes into the ocean, and they're all sorry. And I walked and walked and walked. I couldn't find the ocean. Jesus Christ. I stopped at gas station. I said, where's the ocean, pal? He said, well, you're just in Western Beverly Hills. Got to go by the Veterans Hospital about another 3 miles. Oh, screw that. I was so desperate, I called my sponsor. I hated to, because he hated to hear bad news. I told him about getting fired off this job. I said, Bob, this is classy. Why aren't you working with Bob? Now, let me explain something to you. You know, I've tried to do what you say. I've gone to the meetings. I've tried to be nice, a little bit nicer to people. I go to work and I do things. But, Bob, there's something basically wrong with me. In my judgment, AA is not enough for me. I need something. I don't know what it is, but it isn't available. What am I going to do, Bob? He said, why don't you write your damn inventory the way I told you? And I had just told him a week before, I've taken my inventory with a psychiatrist. Why do you want to take it with an out-of-work actor, for Christ's sake? Cut. What are you going to do that? Have a retake? But I didn't want to say it again because he got so nasty the first time I told him. I said, Bob, in my judgment, that's the last thing in the world I need. My God, in my judgment, I'll be so depressed that I'll just make it worse. You don't know the thing I've done, Bob. And he said, in your judgment. Who cares about your judgment? You live in the back seat of an abandoned car, for Christ's sake. If I wanted your judgment, I'd put my head in the back window and ask you for it. He said, you're a loser. You're a loser. I hung up and I came out of that phone booth. Got a good thing I turned left. I'd have turned right. I'd have been in the ocean. I got walked back to that club 3 miles. Sullivan, give me some paper. I read my inventory. And I wrote and wrote. I put down terrible things, terrible, nasty, rotten things. Things I would never tell my psychiatrist. Guy said one time, why don't you tell your psychiatrist? Because if you're paying that kind of money, you don't want to risk rejection. That's why you don't. You did what, sir? Get out of my office. But first, wash off that chair, will you? Yeah. And I wrote this stuff, and Jesus, at least made me feel a little better. It proved it didn't work. And I jammed it in the back seat. A couple days later, he came by and said, well, don't take your inventory tonight. Not tonight, Bob. Jeez, I'm just starting to feel a little better. I don't want to go through all that dirt and filth. He said, oh, shut up and get in the car. No, I didn't. And he drove from Los Angeles to Oxnard along the ocean, gave me a flashlight, and I read this. And it even read worse than I remember. Just, oh, not even big, wonderful, rotten things. Chicken shit. Rotten. Now that he's going to make me walk back from Oxnard. That's 40 miles. Well, that's all, Bob. You done now? He was over and said, that's the best thing you've done since you got sober, kid. And I said, thought it was. I've taken that trip over 200 times since then. Once with a guy in this room. Somebody else over there with a flashlight. And I'm driving. And they're all the same, basically. You know. Let me explain this part before I read it. The specifics of inventory vary all over hell. But they all have certain good inventories, always have the same elements. Guilt, resentment, feelings of inadequacy, feelings less than, feelings superior than. A few years ago, I heard the daughter of one of the most famous men in the 20th century, and 5 days later, a guy named Ramon Pena, whose father was born under a bridge, and he was born under a bridge, didn't know where his father was. They had the same emotions. She lived in a penthouse, and he just got out of the prison. But the same emotions. That's what makes AA such a remarkable place. When you get down to that level, we are dealing with things we've all dealt with. And that's what AA is about. But after I took that inventory, I really felt so much better. And sometime later, I was looking back at my life and I was thinking, you know something? The day I wrote that inventory is the day I took my third step. Because that's what the third step is. Doing things, whether or not you agree with them, whether you understand them. You surrender to the power greater than yourself, to whom you address yourself. And if you're kind of new, that's what all you got to remember. You're going to hear all kinds of interpretations and insights, but they mean what they say. All you got to do is come to understand, am I having a problem with alcohol? And am I having a problem with sobriety? If either one of these things weren't true, you wouldn't be here. If you could drink, you'd be out drinking. If you stay sober comfortably, you'd stay sober comfortably. When you can't do either, you come to AA. That's all you have to do is admit that you're... Now, that's what an alcoholic is. And secondly, you have to come to believe there's a power here somewhere. In a sponsor, in a group, in a God, something that will enable you not to have to drink to stand it. Even though you can't believe it could be there. Then you have to try to do what they're telling you. That brings that about. And when that day comes, I think to me that's when sobriety is born. I wrote an inventory. I had to go back and make amends to my father, a man I hadn't spoken to for 10 years. All sorts of things. And took jobs and activities and my life began to flourish. But I'm still, you know, unlike many speakers, I have not achieved wonderfulness. I'm still a human being. I still understand why they say don't get too hungry, angry, lonely, or tired. I'll tell you why, because it makes the world look funny. When you're hungry, you'll notice that people all act slow and stupidly. Come on! When you're angry, God sometimes wants you to kill them for their own good. When you're lonely, you know they're all having a party somewhere. But they didn't tell you, did they? And when you're tired, they actually attack you. I drive on the freeway in the morning and evening. One thing I've learned, that, for example, if I get angry at someone on the freeway, I no longer have to chase them past my exit. If I haven't caught them by then, good flying, Red Baron. We'll meet again. A few years ago, a little girl cut me off on the freeway. I was coming off from one freeway to another, and she almost put me in an overpass. And Jesus, my heart. And I really thought I must, you know, when you catch him, you can't do anything anyway. You just give him a ray. You go next to him and go. But this girl, I thought, needed a quadruple ray. She almost killed me. I chased her past by accident up the Pasadena Freeway. I got next to her. I gave her a quintuple ray. And all of a sudden, I realized she was about 17. A little girl, like, I have a granddaughter who looked like her. Long hair and sweet. And I was, what kind of a rotten old bastard have I become? I'm chasing a little girl like my granddaughter up this freeway. So I smiled. And she went. But that's what you find out there, folks. That's why you go to meetings. You learn, because the purpose of AA in the last analysis, it turns out, I'm going to stop when I say this now. The purpose of AA, of finding a power greater than yourself, incidentally, in my life, eventually became AA, And eventually my perceptions changed, became a God that I've prayed to earnestly every day for 40-some years. And I have come to believe that God doesn't hate me. I'm not important enough. I came to believe He loves me. He loves you. He loves us all the same. If He doesn't love us all the same, then He's not a God. He's something else. But I live at peace most of the time, but I think that God loves me. And when I don't act well or I get emotional or upset, He's not angry at me. He's sad for me. Because the rules are there to follow for you and me. But the purpose of all of this is not to make you, you know, tonight I was the longest sober here. I've been sober later this month. It'll be 46 years since I walked off script. No, you misunderstand. Start the buckets around again, the love offering. I've got a lot of expenses. But the purpose of AA is not to get drier and drier. My God, if it was, I'd burst into flame up here. I firmly believe the purpose of alcoholism, I say this on the basis of everything I know and I've learned, because the only therapy I've had since 1958 is this program. So I know that it's not colored by anything else. The only purpose of AA is to very slowly do what alcohol did fast. That's all. To very slowly change my perception of reality. To little by little change my relationship to the world around me. To little by little make myself a little more able and a little more self-respect and them a little less threatening and frightening. And from time to time suddenly realize that scale is up here much of the time. That's a great thing. The last thing I want to say before I sit down, you've got to be careful you don't do it too much. I was kind of a fanatic because I was so goofy and I did it too hard. And when I was 15 years sober, I was doing very well as a marketing director, just doing swell, and all of a sudden, AA kicked into my head. And I resigned my job, and for the last 30 years, I've run the mission on Skid Row that threw me out in 1958. And people say, why do you give up your great career to run this damn mission? And I can't think of a good answer. Well, it was such a significant decrease in salary, I thought it was spiritual. Well, I'm still looking for those two bastards that threw me out. Once I get the... Isn't that? When I go to work in the morning, I do something none of you do. I get out of my car and I step over the bodies of men and women and children dying from alcoholism and drug addiction. And I go home at night and I step over them again. And I've tried and tried. We're not a treatment center. We're way below that. We're just trying to get them alive if we can. And some of them, luckily enough, will go to AA someday. I don't send them there. But it's a great reminder to me what life is about. I'll say one more thing. I got to say this one thing. I'll sit down. You went so far over, I'm going to do it too.
I learned from the master.
In 1963, I was 5 years sober, and I was doing well, had front teeth. I wanted to be the secretary of a group. And the largest group in Los Angeles was the Brentwood Group, and I had a stooge on the chamber, and their directors, they appointed them. I said, go in there, mention my name, I want to be. So he did. I said the next day, how about it? He said, no, died for lack of a second. Oh, shit. So I was going to be sick. But a few weeks later, a little building over in Ohio Street, which AA means you're held, the Tuesday night meeting went bankrupt or something. And they said, anybody wants to rent this building? I said, yeah, I do. And I rented, and I took 9 or 10 tattered followers over there. We started this group called the Pacific Group, and I wrote a format, and I appointed myself secretary. And over a period of time, it grew little by little by little. After a year, we were getting 35, 40 people regularly. And I thought, some groups would have me election now. But I'd be doing these people a terrible disservice because they're new and they don't know exactly what they're doing. They need more guidance. So I'll just sacrifice myself. I won't mention anything. I'll just do it another year. So at the end of 2 years, we had about 55 or 60 people coming. And I looked around this group. It was like an emerging third world country. They're almost ready for self-government, but not quite. We don't need any damn election. I'll just... A couple months later, I was sitting in the kitchen there, and some boob whose life I had saved, I'm sorry to say. Karen said, are we ever going to have an election in this group? I said, what are you talking about? We run by the traditions. We're growing. We're getting to be well known. We're following the traditions. What do you want an election for? He said, oh, don't get mad. He said, just other groups say you're a dictator. And if we had an election, then they couldn't say anything. I said, that's a good idea, Jimmy. So we had an election, and I was swept out of office. I don't care. But I'll tell you what a good job I had done in building a foundation. Even after I left, it really took off. Now it's about 1,000 people every Wednesday night, the largest group in the world by far. Many of you have been there, the Pacific Group in West Los Angeles. And I'm not the secretary. What do I care? But I'm the founder. I'm the founder. And I sit right in the middle, and I give little signals. Nobody pays any attention, but it cheers me up. At the end of the meeting, people will bring newcomers up to see me. They'll say, this is Clancy. He started our group. I'm still in my work clothes, shirt, and tie, so I look pretty good. He said he's been sober a long, long time. He travels all over the world to speak in AA and airplanes, and he's the founder of this group. And they say, oh. And I say things like, hello there. I hope you brought your problems tonight. Many folks leave them here. If they're diabetics, they go into a coma. That's always better. Once in a while, some goof will come up to me, doesn't know who I am. Say, hey, buddy, can you give me a ride back over to the VA hospital? And the great thing about AA is you can think whatever you want to. I can look right into his sick little eyes and think, what? Give you a ride to the VA hospital? I hope you're in the psych ward. That's where you belong. Right, there's 1,000 people in this room who need action desperately. There's one who has given all, year after year after year. I'm not just a well-dressed man here. I'm Clancy I from up in the sky, bringing hope around the world. Now, I can think that as long as I say, okay. And the magic of this program is this. When I drop that puke off at the VA and I'm driving home, my head says, oh, Clancy, is there no end to your goodness? If you're new tonight, get a sponsor. Do what he or she says. Nobody cares what you think. You're a loser. You'll be very glad you did.